Cali girl from California.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Case number 28928, Sitanovich Dubey v. Dubey. Arguing for petitioner, Howard Wittstein. Also appearing for the petitioner, Kimberly Van Horn and Michael J. Green. Arguing for the respondent, Paul Tomar. Also appearing for the respondent, Kimberly Koide and Bruce Lehman.
Good morning and aloha, everyone, and welcome to the Ronald T.Y. Moon Judiciary Complex in Kapolei. We're very excited to be holding our first oral argument in this new building today. And we have arguing for the petitioner, Mr. Glickstein, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Very well. If you'd like to proceed, Mr. Glickstein.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. The record should also reflect the presence of my client, Geraldine Sitanovich, this morning. George Dubey was never divorced from Sylvie Bertin. George Dubey was never married to Geraldine Sitanovich. And George Dubey was never divorced from Geraldine Sitanovich. These are facts. They are facts that are compelled by the record in this case and by the intermediate court decision in the part of the case that they got right. Neither George Dubey nor Sylvie Bertin ever resided in or were domiciled in the Dominican Republic. As a matter of Dominican Republic law, as a matter of Hawaii law, as a matter of American law, in every state in the United States, that means that the Dominican court never had the power, never had jurisdiction of the persons, never had jurisdiction of the subject matter, and never had the power to issue a divorce decree. That means that its divorce decree never existed. It is void ab initio. This case turns on the meaning of void ab initio. Everything that the court needs to decide is contained within the meaning of void ab initio. Voidness has a unique place in the law, and Hawaii has a unique place among the states in enforcing the concept of voidness through Hawaii Revised Statutes 1-6. All you need to do to understand why there is no such thing as practical recognition, why there should not be and cannot be anything called practical recognition, is to look at the definition of void ab initio, which means void from the inception, void from the beginning. It never existed. When something is null and void, it never existed. Estoppel cannot be used to create a right. When you say you're going to give practical recognition, any definition that you look up of what it means to be null is it's absolutely null. It never existed. It cannot be used for any legal purpose. When the intermediate court
said— Mr. Glickstein, if I might interrupt you one moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
It seems to me that the essence of your case is you want to set aside the property settlement agreement that was incorporated in the decree. That's your ultimate goal.
Well, Your Honor, the ultimate goal is to simply have the divorce decree in toto declared void under Rule 60B4. This is a 60B4 case, Judge, and that's what makes it different from any other 60B case and different from any other case. The result of this case is commanded by the standard of review, Judge, Justice Duffy. The standard of review, which was agreed on by the parties below, which was embedded in a conclusion of law that was not appealed from, and which is the standard is right-wrong. The reason the standard is right-wrong is because a court has one job, only one job, on a 60B4 motion, and that is to decide, was the judgment void or was it valid? That's it. Once the court decides that the judgment was void, the court has no discretion and no choice, and the court must declare it void and grant relief under 60B4. This, Your Honor, was in the very first memo that we presented to the family court. And on the on page 6 of our very first memo, we cited and quoted from Wright, Miller, and Kane, which is cited by universally by the courts, and which says, necessarily, a motion under this part of the rule, referring to 60B4, differs markedly from motions under the other clauses of 60B. There is no question of discretion on the part of the court when a motion is under Rule 60B4. Either the judgment is void or it is valid. Determining which it is may well present a difficult question, but when that question is resolved, the court must act accordingly. And that is because if you say, we're going to give practical recognition to this decree that never existed, then it's not null, it's not void, it's just as powerful as it would be if it really existed and it was issued by a valid court. Practical recognition means comedy for you, but not for him. Practical recognition means bigamy is not okay for anybody else in the state of Hawaii, but if you're George Dubey, we'll give you a pass. That is not the law. The law of this place does not depend on who asks the question. An estoppel is a court saying to a litigant, don't darken my door because you have committed an act so unconscionable that you don't deserve to be heard. An estoppel is the court protecting itself from a litigant. An estoppel is an affirmative defense.
Mr. Glickstein, putting aside for the moment the question of whether estoppel is applicable or not, you, as you pointed out, this is a Rule 60B4 motion, so a motion that comes after judgment is entered. Isn't it true that certainly the ICA appears to have adopted a relatively narrow view of when we will find that a judgment is in fact void, that it has to be, the court has to have plainly usurped judicial power that didn't exist, and that as long as the court has the general power to adjudicate the issues in the class of suits to which the case belongs and has jurisdiction over the parties, that then the judgment is not void. In this context, did not the family court have jurisdiction to consider a divorce and have personal jurisdiction over the parties? So that would be the end of the analysis.
No, Your Honor, the family court never had subject matter jurisdiction, and we cited 3 cases for that. One was the Groover versus Groover case, which is a Florida appellate case, which is directly on point, which said that because the marriage was bigamous, the court never obtained subject matter jurisdiction. The other is Tagupa versus Tagupa, in which the intermediate court reversed and remanded to the family court because there was evidence that the marriage was bigamous, and so you can't get a divorce if the marriage is bigamous. You can only get an annulment. And that's why we went on at such length in our brief, Your Honor, to talk about this, because it's very clear that the family court did not have subject matter jurisdiction. When opposing counsel first appeared in the case and filed an untimely motion, he tried to make the argument that you don't need to be married in order to get divorced, that the family court has subject matter jurisdiction to divorce unmarried people. We responded 24 hours later with 2 appellate cases from this state, State versus Alagao and State versus Miyahira, both which stand for the proposition that in family court there are subject matter jurisdictional questions of fact. And the subject matter jurisdictional question of fact in this case is, were they a legally married couple? If you look at page 1 of the record of appeal, it's the first page of the divorce complaint, the form divorce complaint. Paragraph 2, which you can't change, you can't check a box, you can't fill in a blank, and you can't cross out, says the parties are a legally married couple. If they're not legally married, there is no subject matter jurisdiction.
If I could ask, Mr.
As a matter of law.
There certainly are a number of cases which would hold that someone who's not been divorced can't marry until that divorce is final or valid. But we're in a collateral attack situation here. We're not in the original case. We're not in a situation where the petitioner was asking for the divorce to be annulled. We're now in a situation after judgment has been entered sometime later. Is it not, or are there not different views and certainly cases that have held that in that context there's a higher burden in terms of when we would intervene and say that there's a lack of jurisdiction? Isn't that, and I think you had recognized it in your, if I recall, in your brief, acknowledge that, in fact, Wright and Miller and Moore, as the two authorities, the authority you mentioned earlier, have apparently taken that narrower view.
Your Honor, every authority, when you actually read the cases, every authority agrees on this, these two propositions. If a judgment is void, not voidable, but void, it can be collaterally attacked by anyone, anywhere, at any time that it comes up. That's number one. So there is no restraint on that. And they cited five cases to support their argument on collateral attack. Four of them were not collateral attack cases. One was distinguished by the same Idaho court 13 years later.
Mr. Goodstein.
Yes, Your Honor.
So under 60B4,
yes, Your Honor.
Whether a judgment is void or not, you agree that we're restricted to determining whether or not the court had subject matter jurisdiction over the persons, and that due process was followed.
In terms of,
those are the three things we need to consider in determining whether or not a case falls under 60B4.
Whether a judgment is void under 60B4. That's correct, Your Honor. And if
and so in this case, at least you agree that two of those factors have been satisfied, that is personal jurisdiction and due process.
In terms of the family court proceeding, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes.
So your only dispute is with the factor of subject matter jurisdiction.
Which is dispositive, yes, Your Honor.
If you look at HRS 580-1, it sets out the jurisdiction of the family court in divorce cases. Hasn't this court ruled that all family court needs in order to obtain jurisdiction in a divorce is that the applicant be either reside physically in the state for, I think, 3 months, or is domiciled in the state?
Your Honor, there's no Hawaii case that I'm aware of in which it is clear that there was a bigamous marriage in which the court has said that the family court had subject matter jurisdiction to award a divorce. And as a matter of fact, Tugupa stands for the opposite proposition. Tugupa says that if you go to family court and say, I want a divorce, and it turns out that you were never married because the marriage was bigamous, you can get an annulment, but you can't get a divorce. And part of what is very clear in the Hawaii law, which makes it different than many other states, Your Honor, is that other states allow their family courts granting divorces to grant divorces in cases of bigamy. And other states allow their courts granting annulments to divide the property of unmarried people. And Hawaii's legislature has never done either one. So it is quite literally a question of whether the court had the power to do what it did. And that's what makes voidness different than everything else. That's why the lack of subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time, unlike anything else in the law. And that's why you can't...
Does it matter whether the judgment was right or wrong when we consider whether the court had jurisdiction?
You mean on the merits? No, it only matters whether the court had the power. If the court didn't have the power, then it doesn't exist. And under our system of government and our rule of law, the courts have been necessarily vigilant. This court throws out cases all the time without being asked because the court determines that it doesn't have jurisdiction. That's what courts have to do. Because if courts, you have this spectacle in this case now, Your Honor, of the intermediate court holding that this divorce in the Dominican Republic never existed, that the court there never had jurisdiction. That means it's void ab initio. You have the spectacle of the intermediate court saying, well, it's true that it doesn't exist, but and that means it's true that they were never married, and that means it's true that they were never divorced, and that means it's true that the divorce decree doesn't exist, but we're going to enforce it against you. Courts
so
don't do that.
As part of the elements of proving a divorce, you would have to prove that there was a valid marriage.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why it's paragraph 2 on the court's complaint for divorce.
So does that factor go to whether or not the court would grant the divorce or not, or whether the court has jurisdiction?
It goes to the question of whether the court has the jurisdiction, the power to decide the case. The court never had the power to grant a divorce. The court didn't have the power to take the first dollar from my client, let alone the millions, and to give it to somebody else. The court didn't have the power to do it. The legislature never gave it the power to do it. When a court realizes that it doesn't have the power to have done what it did, that's why the standard of review is right wrong. That's why there's no discretion. But let me get to Hawaii Revised Statutes 1-6, if I can, because we didn't have a chance to brief that at any level in the fullest way. 1-6 is dispositive by itself. This court, 90 years ago, in Park versus Park, in 1920, this is a unanimous Hawaii Supreme Court opinion reversing a unanimous Hawaii Supreme Court decision issued only 13 years earlier. 13 years earlier, in Godfrey versus Roland, this court held that common law marriages were okay in Hawaii. And it did so by construing the same statute we're talking about here today, which is now 572-1, the marriage license statute. These are the things that you have to do to get it to enter into a valid marriage contract. Number 3 is still the same, same words as it was then. A man cannot be married to another woman when he enters into a valid marriage contract, in order to enter into a valid marriage contract. There were 5 clauses in that statute back then. The 5th one said, and you have to go get a license. In Godfrey versus Rowland, this court said, well, those other 4, including the one that counts in this case, that you can't be married to anybody else, those are all mandatory. But this one here about getting a license, that's directory. So in order to uphold marriages, we're going to say, okay, you can do that. It's okay. 13 years later in Park against Park, this court says they must not have ever looked at this statute, which is now 1-6, which was enacted in 1859. Hawaii is one of only 2 states in the country to enact, to codify the common law principle of void ab initio. Whatever is done in contravention of a prohibitory law is void, although the nullity be not formally directed. Void, not voidable, although the nullity be not formally directed. Void ab initio. Whatever is done in contravention of a prohibitory law never happened. In Park against Park, this court reversed itself and said they must not have been aware of this statute because this statute, they held, must be construed in pari materia with the section that is now 572-1. And as a matter of law, that's all we need to know. That's what they didn't know. We don't like to change precedent, but we have to do it because the law here is so clear and obvious. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Glickstein, I just want to be sure I understand. Is it your position, it really doesn't matter at all that this is a Rule 60B4 motion, the standard of review, or the test that the plaintiff has to meet in order to show that the marriage was valid or void is absolutely the same? No higher standard whatsoever. Is that your position?
The standard for 60B4 is that the court has no discretion and has to decide whether the judgment was void or valid. If the judgment was void, the court has no discretion. The judgment is void if the court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction.
The same test?
The family court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction.
Same test.
Yes, the test for voidness is the same. Okay. The test for voidness of the Dominican decree, the test for voidness of the marriage, the test for voidness of the divorce, they're all the same test. The core, no court will say that there was jurisdiction if there was no personal jurisdiction, jurisdiction of the subject matter, or due process. And this court, in the case that we quoted and cited at length in the briefs, the Wong Kwai Tong versus Choi Yin case, this court said, this is not a question of procedure, it's a question of jurisdiction. And that's why the court said in that case, this part of the divorce decree was void. And that's why it allowed a collateral attack on that decree by a stranger to the decree.
Mr. Glickstein, could I just follow up on one point?
Yes, Your Honor.
I just want to be sure I understand your position. So,
yes, Your Honor.
So we've established that in your view, absolutely the same standard under 60B4 as if it were in the original proceeding for annulment or anything else. So same standard. I want to be sure that's...
In terms of the court's jurisdiction, Your Honor, but right. In terms of whether the 60B4 is about whether or not the judgment is void.
I understand, but the same test apply. The plaintiff or whoever, whatever party comes in,
yes,
faces no greater burden on a 60B4 motion than they would had they raised the issue in the original proceeding. Is that
that's correct?
Your position, okay.
It's either void or valid.
And even if they knew that the argument existed during the course of the original proceeding and they chose not to raise it there, they would be able to raise it at any time in the future indefinitely. Is that your position as well?
Well, Your Honor, we don't need to go there because the facts are undisputed in this case that my client did not know and had no reason to know until after Mr. Duby died that the family court didn't have jurisdiction and that she was never married.
I understand.
But analytically, Your Honor, the case law is clear under all the cases in the federal system, Your Honor. There's a clear majority of courts that take the same position, the same holding about the standard of review on 60B4 and the reason for it. And the reason why the standard is no discretion And in those, you know, 60B says standards is abuse of discretion. But in the federal system, what they do is they say, well, if you want to call it abuse of discretion as the standard, then it's a per se abuse of discretion not to grant relief on a 60B4 motion once the court determines that the judgment is void. Because when the judgment is void, it doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, you can't enforce it against my client. You can't take her money and give it to him if you don't have the power to do it. And once the court recognizes that it doesn't have the power, it doesn't have a choice.
Mr. Glickstein.
Yes, Your Honor.
To follow up on the Chief Justice's question, I understand that this isn't the factual scenario here, but if we go along with your reasoning, a party then could sit on his or her rights for years and years and years, never bring it up till 30 years later, and you're saying the standard is the same for determining whether the
court's standard for determining whether the judgment is void, if the court didn't have jurisdiction, the judgment is void. I understand, I think, where Your Honors are coming from or heading toward, and it's the case that's about the horrible litigants that, you know, they knowingly enter into phony marriages, and then 18 years later when their next wife says, I want a divorce, they say, aha, you can't get one because we're not married. I understand that. But this is one of those hard cases make bad law, Your Honor, because this is not about protecting my client's rights as much as it is about protecting the integrity of the judicial system. You cannot have courts openly enforcing orders that they know don't exist.
Mr. Glickstein.
Yes, Your Honor,
assuming,
my time is up.
That the court has had jurisdiction, the family court had jurisdiction, how do you come under 60B? The ICA said you come under 60B3 with respect to fraud on the court and undue influence. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor. And we cited...
What section would you come under?
60B6.
Why?
Because Hayashi versus Hayashi puts it under 60B6 because fraud on the court is traditionally under 60B6 because this court... In the case,
Hayashi doesn't exactly say that. Do you have any other authority?
I think the name of the case is Shefke, Your Honor. This court's opinion from 2001, which sets out approvingly the case authorities and treatises that say that it falls under 60B6 because it is an extraordinary circumstance.
I think Shefke said 60B6, didn't mention 60B6, but said that 60B said you could file an independent action for fraud on the court.
Yes, Your Honor, I can't be absolutely certain of this, but I do believe that Shefke does invoke the treatises that do put it under 60B6.
Oh, it doesn't. Okay. But let me, I say that only because I wrote it.
I understand.
We're very grateful
for that.
Under the independent action provision,
yes.
Is your pleading, does it fall under the independent action section of 60B?
We believe that it could, Your Honor, but we believe that the court never gets to 60B6. The court needs to vacate the ICA opinion,
well,
decide this case.
If you don't prevail on 60B4, then you have to go to 60B6.
Right, but there's no way that we can't prevail under 60B4 if the court follows the law and case precedent. Specifically, 1-6, Park versus Park, Godoy and Alvarez, and the cases cited in the footnote 12, I believe, in our petition for cert, which is the Oliver versus Oliver case and all of its similar progeny. Because they're all the same. The law cannot impose an estoppel when the people, through the legislature, have been particular about what the law is in a place. What the law is in a place is up to the legislature to decide. It's their call. And when they prohibit, and this court specifically construes that statute to say if it violates a prohibitory law, and this is a prohibitory law that was violated, that's the end of the ball game. It's void ab initio, and if it's void ab initio, it doesn't exist, and you can't bring an estoppel for it because that destroys the core meaning of voidness. It's not void if you give it practical recognition. It's just as alive as if it were real. That's wrong. It's against precedent, and the court should not do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glickstein. Mr. Tolmar?
Thank you. Duffy, Akoba, and Judge Burke. My opponent just spent 20 minutes up here without once mentioning what this case is really about. This case turns on the application of the equitable doctrine of practical recognition avoid decrees. That's what the ICA based its decision on, and there is an enormous body of law supporting the practical recognition of divorce decrees even when they're void. The article we cited from ALR, 13 ALR 3rd, Domestic Recognition of Divorce Decrees Obtained in Foreign Countries Attacked for Lack of Domicile or Jurisdiction, it lists 74 cases, all of which uphold the doctrine of practical recognition even in the face of a void decree. Now, we talk about standard of review. The standard of review is abuse of discretion where a trial court determines facts and decides based on those facts that it will invoke equitable relief. That's what Judge Browning did. He found compelling facts that justified the application of estoppel.
Mr. Tomar, are you conceding that the family court didn't have jurisdiction?
No, I'm not. I'm not conceding that. In fact, when Mrs. Savitanovich applied for the divorce, she already then knew about all the circumstances regarding the Dominican Republic divorce. She knew that her husband had been divorced there when he was not a domiciliary. She knew that his wife was not domiciled there, and she chose. She made an election under 580-2 to proceed with a divorce. 580-2 allows you to choose between an annulment or a divorce, or to even plead in the alternative. Now, this doctrine of practical recognition is based on quasi-estoppel. And really, it's the genesis of it is an article that I urge all of us to read, which is by Professor Clark, the author of the Horn Book in Domestic Relations. The Yale Law Journal, Professor Clark discerned as early as 1960 that there was already a growing body of cases that said that even though a decree is void, we are going to impose a disability on the actor. We're going to say that the person who is now coming in very belatedly to claim that the divorce is void should be barred from doing so, on the doctrine that doing so is completely inconsistent with her prior conduct to the disadvantage of someone else. And Professor Clark talks about that the policy behind practical recognition is the sanctity of marriage.
That's Mr. Omar.
Yes, sir.
The family court had jurisdiction. Do we even have to get into practical recognition?
Actually, we don't. If the family court had jurisdiction,
so what's
it's
your authority
over.
For the fact that the family court had jurisdiction?
Because the parties had the court had personal jurisdiction over both the parties. It had subject matter jurisdiction. The plaintiff alleged that the marriage was valid. She proceeded on a divorce basis.
So the fact that she was domiciled and filed a complaint was enough to give the family court subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes. But
you know, what case is that?
I'm sorry, I don't. That's statutory, essentially.
Okay.
But
so assuming that the court had jurisdiction, what about Mr. Glickstein's argument that he should be able to at least bring this case to be heard before the court under 12b-6?
You mean 60B6, Your Honor?
I'm sorry, 60B6.
Well, clearly 60B6, it cannot be used as a substitute when other grounds exist. His entire case below was founded on fraud and undue influence. He completely miscites the Hayashi case, which does not stand for the proposition that undue influence falls under 60B6. This was a situation, plainly, where no one defrauded the court. No one. In fact, what's interesting is that when plaintiff who filed the complaint for divorce in her matrimonial actions information sheet, she said that her husband's prior divorce was in the state of California. She didn't even tell the court that his divorce.
His theory is that Mr. Duby knew that his Dominican divorce wasn't in fact a divorce because of the subsequent separation agreement. And so when I guess he agreed to the divorce and said they were married previously, then that would be fraud on the court. At least that's the theory.
Well, that's the theory that's completely inconsistent with the finding of fact by Judge Browning, which said that there was no evidence that Mr. Doobie knew that his Dominican Republic divorce was valid and that he and his former wife and the plaintiff all acted in complete reliance that the marriage, that the divorce was valid and that they had a legal marriage. That's the finding of fact. That finding of fact can only be overturned on a clearly erroneous standard of review. The only evidence they had was that separation agreement filed in California where Doobie and his former wife referred to themselves as husband and wife, but in fact they didn't refer to themselves as husband and wife. The mere nomenclature was Mr. Doobie, husband, Miss Sylvie Bertin was designated as wife, but they were not claiming they were married. And Judge Browning properly overlooked that line of facts and looked at all the other evidence which showed that both these parties firmly believed that they were validly married. They held themselves out as husband and wife. They enjoyed the benefits of the marriage. And even after they got a divorce, the plaintiff continued to hold themselves out as married because it was good for her herbal life business. Those are the facts. Those are the findings of fact. This court is not, I doubt that this court is going to review these findings of fact de novo, despite the request of the plaintiff. If we do that, every single litigant in family court is going to want to get a set of five new eyes to review findings of fact. That would be devastating to our system. So we come here clothed with the presumption of correctness of Judge Browning's findings.
Now, undue influence fall under 60B6?
60B3, plainly. It's other misconduct.
Well, I'm asking if it would fall under 60B6.
It would not fall under 60B6, and Hayashi does not stand for that proposition. That's a complete miscitation of Hayashi. In Hayashi, the wife alleged below that undue influence fell under 60B6, but Hayashi never ruled on that decision, or ruled on that claim. It was their decision was based on latches, where the wife waited several years before she came in to attack. So I'd like to get back to this doctrine of quasi-estoppel. Not only is it discussed at length in the Yale Law Journal article, which article has been cited with authority, with approval, in over 30 leading cases, it is in the restatement of conflict of laws.
Mr. Tomar, yes. Is this doctrine commonly applied to someone who wasn't a participant in the prior divorce, which was the case here? She was not a participant in the prior divorce. She was.
Yes, it is. It's applied to. It's exactly applied to the person coming in later in the second marriage, i.e., the plaintiff in this case, who challenges the former divorce.
Isn't it more commonly applied against someone who helped procure that divorce, for example, then got married to one of the parties and then tried to avoid the divorce? That's the more typical case.
That might be typical, but that is not a mandatory element of quasi-estoppel. Our own cases, Hartman v. Bertelman, Ihegma v. Ihegma, don't say anything about that type of participation or that type of former knowledge being an element of quasi-estoppel. It's simply a bar against the actor, the person coming in, who whether that be someone who participated in the divorce or not. The Mayer case, which we cited, and many other cases say that there are no particular set of facts which warrant a quasi-estoppel. More than any other area of the law, quasi-estoppel is dependent upon the particular facts of the case.
What would you say the rule of quasi-estoppel that we should adopt in a case like this?
The rule of quasi-estoppel is there where a party acts completely inconsistently with her prior conduct to the disadvantage of the other party. That is when quasi-estoppel should be applied. Okay, so the Godoy case said it very plainly, if I may just said it colloquially. You can't blow hot and then blow cold. You can't accept all the benefits of the marriage, hold yourself out of being married, and then after you get a divorce where you elected not to attack the prior decree and you wait 3 years until your husband is dead, then finally you come forward and say, oh, wait a minute, I want to attack the Dominican Republic divorce.
So I guess under your rule, as I just heard you articulate it, if the Dominican divorce here was just utterly fraudulent, a forged document, never happened, completely a figment of George's word processor and ability to forge a document that purported to say he'd been divorced, nothing at all ever took place in the Dominican Republic, you would say estoppel properly would apply there because the party had had the benefits of that marriage, even though the marriage was their marriage, even though that prior divorce was a complete fiction.
Well,
is that how
that's an egregious set of facts which did not exist in this case.
Well, I'm trying to understand how the rule applies. The rule you articulated to me would pick up that case. So maybe perhaps you want to narrow the rule or?
Well, I recognize that in many of the cases, the party against whom the doctrine is being applied has some knowledge of the prior facts. I mean, if anything, that might be a possible slight narrowing. But again, according to the rule itself, it really doesn't matter why or how the prior divorce decree was void.
So again, I
would have to say that if you apply the doctrine of quasi-estoppel, where you accept the benefits of that divorce, where you rely on it, where you move ahead and continue to hold yourself out as husband and wife, and you actually enjoy the marriage, then it would apply. Because what Professor Clark says is that when you have a remarriage, the doctrine of quasi-estoppel is especially pertinent. It's especially important.
Mr. Tomorrow, if I could revisit jurisdiction again. Mr. Glickstein says that Tagupa is dispositive of the jurisdiction question. Can you refute that?
All I'm saying, Your Honor, is we believe the court had jurisdiction because the plaintiff came in and properly alleged that she was legally married and chose to get a divorce. But what I'm really saying is that regardless of whether the Dominican Republic divorce was void or not, under the compelling facts of this case, she was barred from now asserting 7 years later in this court today and starting in 2007 in the family court, she was barred from coming in and denying the validity of that prior decree. And it didn't matter whether or not at the time the court granted the divorce, whether it had jurisdiction or not. It didn't matter. None of the cases, there's not a single case cited in ALR or in the restatement in which the fact that or the claim that the divorce was void made any difference or that the court didn't have jurisdiction. It just doesn't matter.
Mr. Tomar, there appear to be some cases that hold that undue influence and fraud on the court may fall under 60B6. So what would be your response be to that?
Well, my response would be that fraud on the court is one of the most rarely granted reliefs ever. The leading case of Kawa...
I just want to say the ICA said it fell under 60B3, but if there is authority that in fact it can fall under 60B6, what's your position on that?
I just follow the prior authority that it's under 60B3.
What about undue influence? Some courts seem to say it falls under 60B6.
None of the cases that they cited that I'm aware of say that. They just cite Hayashi as authority for that, and it clearly is not authority for that.
Well, assuming that there are cases that say it falls under 60B6, what's your response to that?
I would say under Hawaii law, that's not the law. Hayashi is absolutely directly on point.
Well, in Tagupa, there was a seemingly bigamous marriage, right?
Yes.
And even though there was a seemingly bigamous marriage, the family court did not dismiss the case and say, we have no jurisdiction. court, in fact, asserted jurisdiction in Tegucigalpa, even in the face of what seemed to be a bigamous marriage.
And I'm not sure what the question is.
So doesn't that support your position that even if there's evidence of a bigamous marriage, that the family court still would have jurisdiction, and this idea of void ab initio doesn't oust family court from jurisdiction?
That is in support of my position, yes. So a case that really talks about this fraud on the court doctrine, or that could have, is the Kawamata case against DuPont, where DuPont was fined $1.5 million by the trial judge for massive refusal to turn over pertinent documents to the court. Even that case turned on 60B3. And if you look at the Wright and Miller cases discussing fraud on the court, literally every case in the supplement for the past 10 years denies relief under fraud on the court. So they're really time-barred. That's why I think Mr. Glickstein stood up here today and said this is a 60B4 case. But the problem is, I'm sorry.
In Shefke and Matsuura, you're familiar with Matsuura?
Not directly, Your Honor.
This court said in both cases that fraud on the court could be brought as an independent action under 60B. In other words, 60B3 is not the only way we can bring an action for fraud on the court.
There is plenty of authority that says that you can't use 60B6 as a substitute.
It's not 60B6. It's a section that says,
The separate saving clause.
The prior sections, it doesn't prevent an independent action for fraud on the court.
Yes, but the standard seems to be extremely high for fraud on the court. As I say, even a case where one of the litigants failed to turn over completely pertinent records to both the plaintiff and the court, that was not depicted as a fraud on the court. And clearly, this is not a fraud on the court. No one intentionally defrauded the court. I mean, if anyone did, it might have been the plaintiff by not disclosing that the prior divorce was in Dominican Republic and disclosing that it was in California. So I think this case properly turns on the grand equitable scheme of quasi-estoppel. The family court is a court of equity. Judge Browning found facts which perfectly fit into the doctrine of quasi-estoppel, under which a party is precluded from asserting a right inconsistent with a right previously taken. And I might add,
so you're saying that parties can't confer jurisdiction on the court.
I can say that, yes. Parties can confer jurisdiction. The plaintiff did confer jurisdiction.
Is that consistent with the cases this court has rendered? That if the parties structure their complaint in a certain way, then despite the fact that they, in fact, don't have jurisdiction, they can confer jurisdiction on this court?
I'm not saying that precisely, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that regardless of whether the court was properly conferred jurisdiction, she is barred now from claiming that the court did not have jurisdiction on the basis of the Dominican Republic decree. She elected to treat the marriage as valid. And this whole question of knowledge comes up. None of these quasi-estoppel cases talk about knowledge. When appellant talks about cases involving knowledge, those are cases involving equitable estoppel, where inducements, where representations and state of mind are critical elements and reliance. You don't need to show knowledge under quasi-estoppel. IHGMA lists the elements, and it's not part of the elements. And the vast majority of cases dealing with this doctrine don't hold that knowledge is an element when a person is barred. It is simply based on inconsistent conduct, especially when someone gets married after the claimed invalid divorce. How am I doing on my time? Okay. Good. So, at this point, Your Honor, I would just like to go back to the standard of review. They're claiming one of the areas that worries us the most as family court practitioners is the claim that this court should review Judge Browning's findings on a de novo basis because it was a non-evidentiary hearing. There's not a single case that says that. The cases that they cite where the court reviews de novo is when the court reviews the granting of a summary judgment and determines whether there was a genuine issue of material fact. But no case says that just because a case was decided on a non-evidentiary basis will this court sit as judges and re-review every single fact. If that was the case, every litigant from a non-evidentiary hearing in family court would be knocking on the appellate court's door saying, I want a new set of eyes to review these facts. And if this then compelled every litigant in family court to ask for an evidentiary hearing to avoid the impact of the de novo review, family court would be hopelessly clogged. We have an awful lot of non-evidentiary hearings, not only in Rule 60B, but also in cases like UCC, JEA, the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, where we have cases involving jurisdiction and residency issues. These are frequently determined on non-evidentiary basis. We have non-evidentiary hearings on determining whether there's a material change of circumstances to show or to open the door for a modification of custody. So we just don't have the time or the resources to have these types of evidentiary hearings. And in this case, Judge Browning's conduct or conducting of a non-evidentiary hearing was absolutely allowed by the Hayashi case. Hayashi case expressly says a Rule 60B matter can be determined on a non-evidentiary basis based on the papers. All Judge Browning did was follow the law that's been in effect for 30 years. And in so doing, he diligently, skillfully, very intelligently looked at all the documents, listened to hours of arguments, deliberated for 2 weeks, and made findings of fact. So the real question is, in this case, do those findings support his discretion, his determination under his discretion that the equitable doctrine of quasi-estoppel should be applied? The answer is clearly yes. The facts in this case are indeed compelling. And it's not just that the parties held themselves out as being married. It's the fact that when they got married, the plaintiff actually stated that she knew about the Dominican Republic divorce decree. She signed a declaration under penalty of perjury saying that the parties were divorced in Dominican Republic. It's inexplicable why later she claimed that Mr. Doobie was divorced in California. She knew that Doobie and Sylvie Burton were not domiciled in Dominican Republic. She got to meet all of them. She befriended Doobie's prior wife. She bequeathed gifts upon the children of that marriage. They all relied upon the validity.
Been subject to cross-examination? Those facts?
It could have been. But again, the court...
Was it?
No, it wasn't. This was an argument of counsel and a review of declarations.
Would undue influence be something that would be conducive to a hearing in court where you have witnesses coming forward and testifying for and against the claim of undue influence?
Of course it would, yes. That it could be. But the point being, the family court in particular, the court which has the busiest docket of all the courts in the state, is allowed to have a non-evidentiary hearing on these types of claims. And in this case,
an evidentiary hearing also.
It could have one, but the fact that it didn't doesn't mean that we can now retroactively say you were wrong, Judge Browning, in conducting a non-evidentiary hearing. He followed the law.
Well, the standard, as you said, is abuse of discretion.
Yes, in invoking equitable relief.
What in the record precludes a hearing, an evidentiary hearing on undue influence?
What in the record?
What in the record, as it stands now, would preclude an evidentiary hearing on undue influence?
I'm not sure I follow the question.
Is there something in the record that would make it incredible to decide that there was no undue influence?
I think the problem with the question is that it assumes really two different bodies of facts. The undue influence claims are really being tried potentially in a circuit court and in a probate lawsuit, where there are claims that Doobie unduly influenced his wife to make gifts. But that's not what this case is about. This case is about the granting of the divorce and whether there was undue influence in that action. There clearly wasn't. The only facts relevant there was that both sides, they've been found that both sides relied on the validity of the Dominican Republic divorce. There's no claims that Doobie unduly influenced his wife or defrauded her to believe that Dominican Republic divorce was invalid. So, yes, if you wanted to have a major trial trying to rescind conveyances of property made after the divorce, undue influence would be a proper subject of a evidentiary hearing, but not here. That's not what this case was about. I wanted to add to these compelling facts governing or mandating quasi-estoppel was that this is one of the few cases you'll see. If you read all the cases from ALR and the cases that Professor Clark cites, it's very rare indeed that the applicant comes in and actually gets the divorce and then waits 4 years later to collaterally attack. We say that getting the divorce is yet another action of acquiescence and acceptance and election consistent with the doctrine of quasi-estoppel, which applies the doctrine of quasi-estoppel. The plaintiff was there with a lawyer, Raymond Mundo. He was her lawyer. She could have very easily elected to say, well, could you look into this Dominican Republic divorce? But she didn't. And not only did she not do that, she affirmatively stated that it was not a Dominican Republic divorce. Those are acts of election that and acquiescence to the facts, which support this grand doctrine. And again, I repeat, they're acting as if this doctrine isn't even applicable to the case. Their focus on estoppel cases or their focus on voidness totally ignores the claim and the argument that even void decrees can be and frequently are allowed to stand when people have married in reliance on the validity of the prior divorce and move ahead with acquiescence and electing to treat it and to ratify it as valid. One other point that we have not yet addressed. The appellant says that you cannot use estoppel to validate a void act or a void decree. But every case that appellant cites is not a divorce case. Their leading cases for that proposition are the Godoy case and the Alvarez case. Those cases involve, respectively, a bus parking fee regulation and a condominium association's dues. Maybe in those cases you can't use estoppel to resuscitate something that is prohibited by law, but that is not the body of law that's applicable when you're talking about a marriage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tomar. Mr. Glickstein?
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
How much time does Mr. Glickstein have remaining? That's sufficient. I know we had a pending question when your 10 minutes came up. Will that be sufficient?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't believe it will be sufficient, and let me tell you why. I've never had to do this before, and I hope I never have to do this again. But Mr. Tomar has just stood up and blatantly misrepresented the facts, the record, and the law to this court. And he's done it after in every pleading that they filed, they did the same thing. And in every pleading that we filed, we had to clean up their mess. I, as an officer of this court, I'm sorry, Your Honors, I resent it. He knows better, and he should know better. And let me try to tick off the lies, Your Honor. He says she knew all the circumstances of the Dominican divorce. He says she knew he wasn't a domiciliary of the Dominican Republic. He says she knew Bertan was not a domiciliary of the Dominican Republic. Lies. Not in the record. Not in the findings. Not in the evidence. He says he made up a finding of fact that Mr. Doobie didn't know that there was anything wrong. He made it up. He says there was evidence and a finding that she enjoyed the benefits of marriage. There's no finding that she enjoyed the benefits of marriage. There's no evidence that she enjoyed the benefits of marriage. There is not a single fact in the record that says that she gained any benefit by the marriage. Not one. If the court, this is a de novo review on 60B4. I thought the court would have read the briefs. I thought the court would have read the record. I thought the court would have read the declaration of Sylvie Bertan. Any first-year student in law school who is exposed to the hearsay rule and the rule on competency would tell you there is no admissible evidence in Sylvie Bertan's declaration for anything that happened after 1998. She says she met George and Jerry in 1996, saw them in 1997, saw them at Disneyland in 1998, period. And then she goes off on the next page about what George told her happened, which we call hearsay, and about how they held themselves out after the marriage, which she had no basis at all to know. Made it up. Made it up. He denies that knowledge is an element of quasi-estoppel. That's a misrepresentation of the law of this state and every other state that has quasi-estoppel. Knowledge is not only an element, it's an absolutely essential element. We cited the Anderson case. They didn't rebut it. The ICA correctly cited the Anderson case and then blew the test. The test is three parts. Did you have knowledge of every material fact? No. The material fact was that the Dominican decree was null. It's a fact. We proved it was a fact. The ALR annotation says nullity is a fact that can be proven between any parties in any courtroom where it becomes relevant. Knowledge is required. The first case that adopts quasi-estoppel, the Hartman versus Bertelman case, cites the Humes case, which holds that full knowledge is required. Additional authority, full knowledge is required. Full knowledge is required for every prong of quasi-estoppel, whether it's election, waiver, acquiescence, or acceptance of benefits. 28 Amjur estoppel and waiver, section 60 and 66. Section 66, acceptance of benefits requires full knowledge. It's even worse for them because Anderson cites Robinson versus McWane, and Robinson versus McWane explains, and Anderson says, you not only have to have knowledge of all the material facts, you have to have knowledge of the legal ramifications of all of those material facts, and you have to have knowledge of what your legal rights are. They don't get to first base, let alone second base or third base. They flunk the test on its face. A family court judge has no business making findings of fact on disputed issues of fact without taking evidence. There was Sylvie Bertan's declaration match up with Sylvie Bertan calling herself the wife in 1996. How can you say she relied on anything? And it doesn't matter if she relied on anything because she and Mr. Doobie are the last two people in the world who are allowed to rely on the Dominican divorce. The last two people in the world. Your Honor asked him, he misrepresented what the ALR annotation says. All of the cases are cases where the person that's barred is the person who got the bad divorce or the person who participated and procured the husband in waiting who paid for it, who went on the trip. Those are the people who are estopped. There's no case in the ALR annotation or anywhere else that estops a completely innocent person like my client who never met the wrongdoer until a year after the bogus divorce. There's no case. The doctrine is never applied against innocent third parties. The essence of the doctrine of quasi-estoppel is an unconscionable inconsistency. The inconsistency has to be unconscionable. The record contains uncontradicted evidence that she didn't know that his divorce was bogus until after he was dead, and she moved right away as soon as she did. Uncontradicted evidence. The court has to look at the reason for the change. I have cases, which I sent them. Dressel versus Weeks, 779, P. Second, 324, Alaska, 1989. Covington Industries versus Resintex, 629 F. Second, 730. Blaney versus West, 209 F. Third, 1027. Rhodes versus Miller, 179 Southern, 430. Beck versus Beck, 624 Southeast 2nd, 411, and 593 Southeast 2nd, 445. No evidence of any benefit. None. None on the record. As a matter of law, it's their burden. Even if you allow an estoppel, it's an affirmative defense. They have the burden to bring the evidence in. They have the burden of persuasion. What are the facts the intermediate court purports to rely on to say quasi-estoppel is okay in this case? She waited 11 years, yeah, because she didn't know for 11 years, and latches is not a defense to a 60B4 motion because the thing is void and never existed. The thing that makes voidness unique is that you don't have to do anything if it's void because it doesn't exist. If it's voidable, it's not void until a judge says it's void. If it's void ab initio, it doesn't exist. You don't have to do anything until it gets in your way. And as soon as the court realizes it's void, that's the end of the ballgame. But if you get to quasi-estoppel, the Hurston case from North Carolina, distinguishing Mayer, is the place to go. The person who comes from the... Yes.
They don't have to prove estoppel if there is jurisdiction in the family court, right? Because estoppel goes to jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if there is jurisdiction, then they don't need...
But there is no jurisdiction. There never was. Your Honor's point about Tagupa is, with all due respect, Your Honor,
there are two cases.
It doesn't help them.
There are two cases, Whitehead and Puckett, which construe 580-1 and say all you need to give the family court subject matter jurisdiction is that the applicant for the divorce is domiciled in the state or has lived 3 years in the state.
Your Honor, those were not cases in which these issues were involved, and if they were...
They go to jurisdiction.
Yeah, but they're...
Right or wrong, whether the judgment was right or wrong, the court had jurisdiction.
This court never had jurisdiction. Springer versus Thompson, which we quote repeatedly, of course the term divorce cannot be used where there was never a marriage, because if there was never a marriage, you can't possibly have a divorce. As a matter of pure logic and settled law, we cited cases which they never rebutted. The reason the form complaint for the court says you're legally married is you don't have the power to divorce them if they weren't. The reason that the Tagupa case doesn't help them, Your Honor, is that the jurisdiction that the family court had left once it was obviously a bigamous marriage was annulment jurisdiction. You can plead in the alternative, but you can't get relief in the alternative. You either are entitled to a divorce or you're entitled to an annulment or you're not supposed to be there. But Tagupa is our case, it's not their case. But what troubles me is making up the law.
If you could wrap up your remarks, and I'll give you 2 minutes to do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Parties cannot confer subject matter jurisdiction on a court. That's the law. Justice Acoba referred to it. It doesn't matter if they agreed that there was jurisdiction. There was no jurisdiction. The court never had the power. If the court did have the power, then you go to Hurston, which says that as a matter of law, the one who comes from the tainted divorce is the one with unclean hands. If you get past that and you get to the merits of the estoppel, they don't make it to first base. You have to have unconscionable inconsistency, which they don't have. They had to show full knowledge, knowledge of the legal implications and knowledge of the legal rights. They don't even claim to have shown knowledge of the legal implications and knowledge of the rights. If you get past that, every prong of quasi-estoppel is, as a matter of law, not satisfied. There's absolutely no evidence of any benefit. And the Beck versus Beck cases stand for the proposition, if you're saying there was an acceptance of a benefit, you got to put in some evidence of a benefit. I don't know about you, but meeting Sylvie Bertin does not strike me as a benefit of the marriage. That's what the ICA seized on. Well, she met Sylvie Bertin. Well, that's enough to estop her. This is such a total miscarriage of justice that we shouldn't literally even have to be here, Your Honors. And whether this court decides this case on the basis of estoppel is not available as a matter of law because of the standard of review, 1-6, Godoy and Alvarez, and Oliver versus Oliver. Those are four reasons why the defense doesn't exist. The fifth one is Hurston. If there is such a defense, as a matter of law, he had unclean hands and can't raise the defense. And the sixth one is, if you get to the actual elements of quasi-estoppel, and you don't have to decide what they are, you already decided what they are. They don't make it. No unconscionable inconsistency, no knowledge, no knowledge of the impact, no knowledge of the rights, no benefits, no waiver, no acquiescence, and no election. To make an election, you have to know you have a choice. To acquiesce, you have to know that there's something wrong that you're acquiescing to. It's baseline law.
Thank you, Mr. Glickstein.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll take this matter under advisement. Thank you very much.
Please rise. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii stands adjourned until further notice.